Now this is New Rio, Barber 2, this New Rio, Barber 2, this New Rio, Barber 2, Channel 1 Right. This beginning of Channel 1 Right and continuation of talk on Sunday morning, the 26th of October 69, Sunday morning, the 26th of October 69. This Channel 1 Right, the beginning of New Rio, Channel New Rio, and it's Channel 1 Right, Channel 1 Right, and it's Sunday morning, the 26th of October 69, Sunday morning, the 26th of October 69. And that little gun shop with a gun on each side.
I remember that shop, and I wasn't in it that much. But it was one of these typical little country stores. It had, you know, the bow and arrows in the front window and the rack of knives on the counter and the pistols under the counter, and all along the walls were the rifles in the rifle racks. But back at the back, the men used to come in from around, and they'd gather and talk. And they'd sit around, and they'd trade guns, and they'd trade talk, and they'd discuss the rifle shoots around. And Don used to spend hours in there. When he was 8, 9, 10, he used to go down there and just sit and listen. When he was 11, 12, 13, 14, he used to trade.
Oh.
And he used to go down there with a knife or a 22 or something like that, and they'd sit around and talk guns, and occasionally he'd trade, come back with something else. And he got invited. He'd get talking to these people, and they'd take him to rifle shoots and muzzle loading shoots. That same thing that he used, was able to use on the tour, he could use there. He just could talk. He can talk to people. Now I don't know how he does it, because I can't do it. Not like he does. I can't walk up to somebody I've never met before and get in a conversation. But he got talking to the head man at Glastonbury, and the man asking him, said, well, stick around and stay around and help us with the dig. Just he meant right then, just stay there and grab a shovel and spade and dig in. And Don said he couldn't. He said he had to go on. And he didn't have the clothes for it, he said. So he headed out towards Minehead, and the country got duller and duller. And he got to Minehead and decided there wasn't anything there after all that he was interested in. I think the truth was that the further he went, the more he was thinking about going back. So he turned around and he went back and he got himself a room for the week. And he went up and started working at the tour. And it couldn't have been very easy. I know that hill. It's absolutely steep, and you can't take a car up or anything. You got to walk up there. And every morning he'd have to climb that hill, get up there. It's a good long, good nice hike, maybe. But they worked while he was there. They worked down through. He would collect things. You know, if they can't use something, they'll let you take it. If there's a lot of it around, or if it's not rare, or something like that, you can pick it up. And he came home with bits of glass from they were cast offs from where they'd had the furnace for the making glass for another chapel that had been up there. He's real proud of those. You should see them. He had them wrapped up and everything. But they're flaky because they've been under pressure, and they're old. And they just, if you aren't careful, they'll just flake off. And they've lost the transparency, too. They aren't clear anymore. They aren't, you can't see through them anymore.
Are they lamb bones?
That's glass. Lamb bones came later. Just when he was ready to leave, just when he had to leave.
Oh, that's the shot of glass.
That's the glass.
Where the man was making glass.
Yeah. They discovered You see, the where the kiln was, where the furnace was.
About 15th century, you said.
Yeah, this was about 15th century. I dig fast, I tell you, because it got from the 15th to the 6th while he was there. they found the place, you know, they found the place where the furnace had been, where they'd made the glass to go into the windows, and these mm-hmm. were cast offs mm-hmm. from the windows. They hadn't actually ever been in the window. And Don was fascinated with things like they started digging. You can tell just by the difference in the soil what was there. And they found some steps, and they started following them down. They didn't go any place. It's the sort of thing that's very intriguing. I think it's one of the things he enjoyed. The steps didn't go any place.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started, when they got about to the, just before he had to leave, they got down to the 6th century layer.
And Arthur's time.
That's Arthur's time. And they found some things. They found lamb chop bones. We brought about 3 of them back. And he was really excited about that because he said that the way that the man figured it, if it had been, see, the theory was that it had been a religious community there. But from all the other evidence they've gathered from around, for one thing, a religious community would probably have had laws about meat.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, there was a lot of religious activity in the village below. And he thought they're just theorizing, but they think that Arthur was probably a little bit at odds with the church, but he couldn't be too far away from them, so that he would have to come to Glastonbury. It was the religious center of the area. He'd have to come there on pilgrimage, but he wouldn't want to stay there. So he'd retire to his little mountaintop, and he could have his lamb chop bones up there, which he couldn't have done if he had been down in Glastonbury. So Donald has a couple of the lamb chop bones, because that's one of the most solid evidence they've got that it was military and not religious.
Uh-huh.
That had the write-up of the findings. And he grabbed hold of that and disappeared for a while. I didn't see him for 2 days after I brought that back to him. And went to take a look at it. Don has been fishing around with Arthur. When I was there, I did a little fishing around with Merlin. I didn't get very far. Not nearly like he did. There was a boy, a man, who kept a horse out at Tilt. And he thought, he was interested in the Arthurian. As a matter of fact, he used to come out and he'd point out his horse, which was a white, stubby-looking Irish horse, and he would say, "Now that's the kind of horse that Arthur would have ridden." I'd take a look at her and I'd say, "Oh, poor Arthur, you know." He was determined that that horse was the perfect model of an Arthurian horse. Besides that, she was white. She'd look out with her beautiful eyes and think, just don't pay any attention to him. Long-suffering eyes, at any rate. But he would start to going on and start talking about Arthur, and the only thing I really gathered from him was that apparently there are some Welsh poems, a collection of Welsh poetry that dates about early 6th century, that according to Welsh legend was written by the teacher of Merlin. And it's some of it, I think he said, some of it was the sort of prophetic, in the prophetic line. And it was later and could be applied, you know, to Arthur. But apparently these things have not been translated, and I've never found anything else about them particularly. And he said that from what he had found, the scholars started using the same tactics I said they used with lamb chop bones. That if the lamb chop bones were there, it must have been military, and therefore it must have been this, that, and the other, and working from one slim little thing to a big conclusion. He said that he figured that there's no reason to figure that Merlin didn't exist, because the poetry exists, and the legends, every time they find out something, they usually find out these legends are not so far-fetched as they seem, especially something like that. And so, why not?
But he was a crank.
Well, he wasn't a crank. He just carried things a little far, like saying his horse was a perfect example of a Arthurian chaff a little bit. He read and he remembered. He had the sort of memory that he could just draw on fact after fact after fact, and he could probably have told you the page where he got it and the book as well. But he had a way of putting it across that made you think, made you sort of take everything he said a little bit in askance and want to go check it to be sure. Because he came across with a sort of know-it-all. You couldn't say anything that he wouldn't come up with something else or somebody else to either, maybe sometimes to support you, but usually to prove his own little idea that he had come up with.
Did he look like that?
Well, he was one of these men that always looked like a boy. Short blonde hair and sort of expression that when he's 75, he'll still look like he's 22. Which is not always bad. Jim McConkie has that, and it's beautiful. But in Philip Barker, it didn't come over quite the same way.
And he talked your ear off.
He would if you let him. He'd talk for hours if you let him. That's why I never got much more on this Arthurian business, because I was afraid to get him started, because I wouldn't have time to stay and listen. I'd have to go do something else, and he...
Well, in the background, you see, of all you say, all the Arthurians are cranks. You and Donald and your mother.
Yeah, we like the cranks in our own way. We don't like Yeah. Interested to it, to exclusion.
You got it.
State my point, because that's exclusion, yeah.
Yeah, so the lamb chop stated.
It's been stated.
With your lamb chop.
Yeah.
I said it in the way it can be said, but I'm not going to go further.
Thank you.
Because I'm just as much a crank as any of them.
That's the
tip. That's right.
That's perfect, Bobby. You couldn't sat up all night and couldn't have thought of it any better.
I just review the evidence, look at it from the other side. That's
right. I can see there's always, when you deal with something like Arthur, you're always in danger of running off in your own little line. Like I said about the American scholars on Arthur, they always seem to be following their own, wanting to prove their own little thing.
Mr. T.H. White?
But he's not going to prove his own thing. He never denies it, which puts him a bit above the rest, I think. He
yeah.
never denies it. He never, he as a sort of a eventually it turns into a discussion of mankind and peace and ability of man to be able to even in any way achieve peace, universal or otherwise. Of course, there have been more obvious things than that in the book. There's one beautiful thing where Arthur is turned into a crane. I think it's a crane. And he's in among them, and he's living as they do. No, it's geese. It's a geese. He's living as they do, just grazing on the flats. And he starts talking to one of them, and he says he notices that they never fight among each other. And they fly in groups, but the groups never fight. And they follow a leader, but the leader never leads them to war. And he starts in on chivalry, and he says how grand it is, and how beautiful, and how triumphant war is. And he can't understand the geese, and the other goose looks at him and says, "Because you're a child." And of course, there he's using this. It's his statement.
I think that's valid.
Yeah. We almost use Arthur for our own little thing, but that's part of the magic. No, what Donald finds in Arthur, I really couldn't say. It's a way to keep seeing things the way my mother, the seeing the world. Because Merlin, the magic of Merlin with the owl on his shoulder, that's in white, with his musty little house and his use of the animals to teach Arthur. That's what keeps me looking at things. It's so easy for me to just stop looking, stop seeing the world, to just not look at a bird or a flower or anything. It's so easy for me to not do that. But Arthur, even the Arthurian legend and Mallory or anything like that, anything that can remind me of that keeps me looking. It's the thing I go back to.
Yeah, that's still the position of crank, because the odds are against you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The weight of most of the evidence is against you.
You're deliberately using this because, not because it's true, because this does it.
Well,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I always find that the information that scholars have finally decided that there might have really been an author. I think it's interesting. I wouldn't stop them researching for the world. As a matter of fact, I go in and dig with them. But no, it wouldn't make much difference.
You know, Captain Parker went to an Arthurian world conference once.
Captain Parker,
marvelous. If we could talk, he could talk to us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see. He has a Middle East background. He can read all that.
Yeah.
Roscoe has done the same thing.
Yeah.
He's sort of ridden his hobby horse. Mm-hmm. When the McElroy are in, you see, he's all right, and when they're not in, he's not all right. Mm-hmm. See, you get into Thoreau from Poor Richard, that gives you a little bit to look for. And he has that remarkable passage that everybody knows, ought to know, on building his little house, cabin. Now, all sorts of things to look at in it, but what it builds up to is a comment on Poor Richard, or he uses Poor Richard as springboard. That long passage starts near the end of March, 1845. I borrowed an axe and went down to the woods by Walden Pond, near to where I intended to build my house.
and began to cut down some tall, arrowy white pines, still in their use for timber. Now you see, this can be taken in the sense, you see, of independence, just being independent. Independent craftsman, doing it yourself. That's a very, very limited view of it, you see. As Thoreau said, you know, he didn't go to the woods to live cheaply. So, all that matter of prudence from poor Richard is a lesser motive. He's conscious of it.
There are all sorts of little sidelights. My days in the woods were not very long ones. Yet I usually carried my dinner of bread and butter and read the newspaper in which it was wrapped. At noon, sitting amid the green pine boughs, which I had cut off, and to my bread was imparted some of that fragrance. You see, that's not poor Richard. That's, he makes an occasion of it. And he it's not pure work, you see. That he does. That looks forward, you see, to that remarkable statement over there in sound. I did not read books the first summer. I hoed beans. They I often did better than this. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment for any work, whether the head or the hands. You see, he doesn't sacrifice the present moment, see, and he reads the newspaper, and takes on his food, takes on those things. I like a broad margin of my life. And he has the beginning of a little reverie that he doesn't actually go into there. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise to noon, wrapped in a reverie. But he doesn't pursue that there, I'm sorry to say. I could rewrite it. And now the high point of the building the cabin is pure Poor Richard. See, I have thus a tight, shingled, and plastered house, 10 feet wide by 15 long, and 8 feet, an 8-foot post, with a garret and a closet, and a large window on each side, and two trap doors, one door at the end, and a brick fireplace opposite. It's large and commodious, he's saying. The exact cost of my house, paying the usual price for such materials as I used, but not counting the work, all of which was done by myself, was as follows. And I give the details because very few are able to tell exactly what the houses cost. And fewer still, if any, the separate cost of the various materials which compose them. Boards, $8.35. Refuse shingles for roofs and sides, $4. And what a person normally does, you see, is just pass over the point and look at this as sort of picturesque, old-fashioned, those refuse shingles. Chalk, latch, hinges, screws, nails, mantel tree, and hair. And they try to reconstruct it, and then reconstructing the building methods of that time, there's not much object in that. That is for the general reason. And what he's saying there, you see, is that he knows the lessons of Poor Richard and prudence, and that he can outdo Poor Richard on his own ground. That he found that prudence is a useful virtue, but a minor virtue, or a minor set of virtues. He has another little statement about that. I never able to find things. Yes. Don't you remember that little thing he says in that same section of economy? I've always endeavored to acquire strict business habits. They are indispensable to every man. And he talks about the Yankee tradesmen, the ones that go around the world to cafe. Now, you see, Poor Richard, I think, is his springboard. But what the essence of him, you see, is that is Emerson and that essay, Nature.
some of the statements is the biographer brings out in that Thoreau discovered and lived by. And I find a good many of Thoreau's statements are cranky and inconclusive and lead in no particular direction. Society is commonly too cheap. I think, you see, he assumes that he can't restate Emerson. He can't give you the whole theoretical background for it. He's got to assume something, you see. So then you're thrown on it. Now, here's the thing. You can read two or three of these little Emerson essays and get into Thoreau, but I have never yet encountered any of the young people who can make their way in Emerson. Now, they read him sometimes. They used to read him in high school, and they will come out, you see, and tell you some of these Emersonian statements, trust thyself, every heart vibrates to that iron string. But see, that's not Emerson, that's Poor Richard. If they are reading, that's a remarkable thing, how they can read Poor Richard into something that is, has nothing whatsoever in common with it. Now what he does, he uses the self-reliance, that's from Poor Richard. But he makes his own statement. And for that simple thing, what his statement is, I see, Barbara, let's see. This is Sunday morning. And Saturday morning at breakfast, that's a bad time, you see, to have to jump anybody. We worked through this. And then Friday night, you see, you'd read Thoreau and got into him pretty well. And Friday night, you went through this material. So you might say you were ready to report on it. Now, I don't find any substitute for that, and the inevitable feeling a person has is, now here I've gone through it, yes, and all my background reading at stake, I've got to be able to talk about this. But you see, yes, I say the statement he makes, he says, but you see, the words don't come. And you just sit there on tenterhooks. And it has to be that way. It simply has to be that way. I don't think any amount of scholarship will take a person into these Emersonian essays. It'll take them into it, but you get a hybrid sort of thing that's not really here. I don't know that I would try to sit off in the corner and lecture on this and just say what the statement is and how he works it out. I think it's best just to let him say it, you know. I read the other day some verses written by an eminent painter that were original and not conventional. And there's the heart of the matter. If you can just see it, that's his statement. And he says the soul always responds, hears an admonition in such lines, let the subject be what it may. And the soul throws you off, and the admonition throws you off. And you still haven't made contact. To believe your own thought. To believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius, but it'll be taken in the sense of Poor Richard. Speak your latent conviction, and it shall be the universal sense, for the inmost in due time becomes the outmost, and I don't know what he means with that. And this is the first clue I have, and our first thought is rendered back to us by the trumpets of the last judgment. Now the last judgment throws me off, but I can see for the first time what he means by original. See, he doesn't hang on to just one term. He shifts it as he goes along. Here the first thought. But all of it is simply invites violent misreading. First thoughts, you see, to us now simply cannot mean what it means. It has to be Freudian. It could be a sort of reverie. People could take it as a sort of reverie, musing, sit out on the lake and watch the fish and all. But you see, that's not his thought. But my first thoughts are more Freudian than they are what he thinks are. Freudian, there's always a clash in the Freudian. There's always that clash, you see, I have that clash. You see, I argue with somebody over the fence corner, fence row, and I will go out on my tractor to mow, you see, and I'm sort of biting my lips on that issue. That's not his sort, of course. Familiar as the voice of the mind is to each, the highest merit we ascribe to Moses, Plato, Milton, is that they set at naught books and traditions, and spoke not what men, but what they thought. A man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across the mind from within. Now there's the next light for me. It's not fraud and it's not prudence. It's that gleam of light which comes from within. More than all these things, you see, that you learn from the firmament of bards and sages. And yet a person dismisses it without notice, dismisses his thought because it's his. And on he goes. Now the part, one of the little parts there that where he kind of advances the thought. You see, what he's saying here is that the individual is this inner light. He is this this perception. And I read in one of the books, you see, where that's all, the only point of view that Emerson ever had. His whole life was spent on working that out. You can take transcendentalism and draw charts on the board to see the you know, how the faculties emerge and are connected. But it's, well, it's simpler than that. If you don't watch out, see, footnotes will interfere with your thought. I like this. The nonchalance of boys who are sure of a dinner and would disdain as much as the law to do or say ought to conciliate one is a healthy attitude of human nature. That has that little broad margin that Thoreau talks about. And Thoreau got his broad margin in some of those little thoughts you see from Emerson. That's part of this world that he's living in. Now, you see, you're simply a force to think about the misreadings. Now, what he's trying to do is make himself clear, or actually work it out himself. And you see, he brings in society. Society everywhere is and conspires a conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Society is a joint stock company in which members agree with the better securing of the bread of each shareholder to surrender the liberty and culture of each one. The virtue most in request, you see, is conformity, and self-reliance is aversion. Now there's society and the idea of conformity, and then he makes this Emersonian statement. It's not true. But it enabled him to probe. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered with the name of goodness, but must inquire if it be goodness. You see, that's his point of inquiry. That society doesn't allow. You see, society is in conspiracy to with its conformity. So in society, there's no inner light. There's no gleam of light. There's no light that flashes across the inner eye. There's no inquiry. Not this sort of inquiry. Mm-mm. So. And in Emersonian statements, you see, in society, is everybody would jump on you. That's that marvelous passage, this Joanna Barr passage. I remember an answer which, when quite young, I was prompted to make to a valued advisor who would want to importune me with the dear old doctrines of the church. Now, that's a rather patronizing attitude he has here. On my saying, what have I to do with the sacredness of traditions if I live wholly from within? My friend suggested, but those impulses may be from below, not from above. I replied, they do not seem to me to be such, but if I am the devil's child, then I will live like the devil's child. Now you see, no one doubted that Joanna Vox saw her, heard her voices, but there was a great deal of wonder, doubt as to where they came from below. And then the institution, you see, society had to find a way. And she wouldn't allow society that word, and they burned her, and that's what should have happened, you see. Had to be. Now, he carries on a little further. Every decent and well-spoken individual affects and sways me more than is right. I ought to go upright and vital and speak the rude truth in all ways. If any angry bigot assumes this bountiful cause of abolition and comes to me with his last news from Barbados, why should I not say to him, you see, these bigots, you see, as he presents them, and as they needed, apparently, rightly, were fanatics. That's fanatic, sort of fanatic side. Like John Smith, Joseph Smith, the Mormon,
yeah.
You see, who had all those plates. Comes to me with the last news from Barbados, why should I not say to him, go, love thy infant, love thy woodchopper, be good-natured and modest, have that grace, and never varnish your hand uncharitable, your hard uncharitable ambition with this incredible tendency for black folks 1,000 miles away. You see, there's the woodchopper.
There's a lot of Thoreau in that.
Yes, you see. And Thoreau is ready to clash, you see, cross swords, you see, with your fanatics, with your abolitionists, and with your, at this time, he is, with your philanthropist.
You'll even go to jail.
Your goodness must have some edge to it. Now, that's Thoreau.
Yeah.
Don't you know where it's got to have some edge to it? He's going to crow like Chanticleer for no other reason? No, that's not. I don't know about that. The doctrine of hatred must be preached as a counteraction to the doctrine of love, where that pules and whines. I shun father and mother and wife and brother when my genius calls me. Now you say, you can't do that. Well, you can't ever say anyway. It's an overstatement. Jesus said it, you know. So you can have a little of the, transfer a little of the Emersonian statements.
Who is my father? My mother.
Yeah, you see, you may reduce Jesus to Poor Richard, too.
Yeah.
Could be done.
Could be done.
Well, now, you see, actually, Emerson never clashed with his neighbors, and he contributed to the relief societies. As a class of persons to whom, by all spiritual affinity, I am bought and sold, for them I will go to prison if need be, but your miscellaneous popular charities, the education of college of fools, the building of meeting houses to the vain end to which many now stand, alms to such and thousandfold relief societies, though I confess with shame I sometimes succumb and give the dollar, it's a wicked dollar. What he's doing is thinking of society. He's not allergic to society. Emerson himself, you see, lived in pretty much is a conformist. It's the mental side of it. He has to not be bound mentally by society. That's the conformity. And then he has the consistency. Don't you know, last year, when all the elections were on, one of the standard questions, especially the news people, you'd think they'd know better. They wouldn't do that. They'd ask President Nixon, now, aren't you changing? Isn't that, you've been inconsistent? And instead of inviting him to change his mind, you see, and respond to all these enormous issues with a fresh view, they hold him to the consistency. Now, you know, you can approach this in a right, and he does, as in a sort of metaphysical, theological way. He has a whole section in here, you see, on the faculty that he's talking about. Anne Hutchinson, he puts that in, and what's the term he uses for her? Oh, don't you know? Antinomian.
Antinomian.
That is the term, you see. They were all allergic to Anne Hutchinson and that antinomian doctrine, you see. They had to have an institution in between. And they expelled, they were harsh. They expelled her. Turned her out to the wolves from Rhode Island. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Roger Williams.
And Roger Williams, yes.
If I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a living thing. And at the end, you see, he says anyone who has this insight, it must work a revolution in all the offices and relations. All his duties, you see, in relations. And then he names several cases and prayers and all those things. And you could name them for yourself or look at his. Now, here's the thing in American Scholar. It's a very simple thing. It's a very simple thing. You say, yes, what he's interested in here is education of the scholar. He says that. You skip over the introduction. That's a little beside the point. Takes a little bit off the subject.
Yeah.
And he gives you these three factors in the education of the scholar. And you can answer those on any occasion. You can say nature's the first, and what's the second? Books are the second. Tradition, and the third is
the past,
or living, without knowing anything whatsoever. What are you talking about? Absolutely not. What are you talking about? I'm going to show you how elusive it is. Nature, well, put it this way. I mean, the whole occasion. This is a rather large question he's raising. It's not so much education scholar, but he's thinking about how to make scholars, and that means to institutionalize them. And an institution, you see, is society. And once you make an institution of it, you're gone. It's mechanical from then on. You see, your sword is lost. And over in Sunday school, they won't give you St. Paul's glimpses. They'll give it to you as doctrine, as if St. Paul knew.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Paul doesn't work out anything, hardly anything. Most of the heart of it is his glimpses.
Mm-hmm.
In the twinkling of an eye, where does it go? The trumpet shall sound, and you shall be changed. You see, you go from mortal to immortal, just like that. And it's a remarkable glimpse, you see, in a religious or theological way. But now you institutionalize that, and you get pretty heavy-handed handling. Now, here's a curious thing, you see. Nature. There is something irresistible in the mind to use these abstractions. as if they know what the abstraction means. Society is perfectly clear. An institution is perfectly clear. Nature is perfectly clear. But it's not. And there's no nature in this. There's absolutely none.
It's always such a surprise to me.
The first in time, the first in importance of the influences on the mind is that of nature. We ain't saying anything about it. What he does is skip a line or two and get down here to one of the great foes, obstructions to nature, and that's science, and the essence of science is classification. Classification begins. To the young mind, everything is individual, stands by itself. But as he learns in school, he sees. He doesn't see the thing itself any longer. He sees the classification. Now that came up, Barbara. I think one of the nicest little cases that I ever saw.
I hope it's what I'm thinking about.
Yes. Don Hurley was down here with his little boy. And he says, "Now, Miles, what is that bird?" And it just occurred to me. I'd never thought of it before. And he's sharp, all of them are sharp. I said, "Don, all you're doing is pushing him into classification. He'll tell you the name of the bird and think about something else. It's one of these little sparrowhawks."
Oh, yeah.
"And he has that beautiful color and flight. What you ought to say is, what's that hawk doing?" The boy knows it's a hawk. It doesn't matter what the name of the hawk is. And what the hawk is doing is looking for grasshopper. But he does it in such a magnificent way. So you ought to let the bird live and not classify him and sort him down. Now that's all Emerson talks about. No nature in it. But I've never yet seen anyone read through that who didn't come out and say, "Know thyself is the same thing as study nature."
Oh,
yeah. Now you see his books. The past, you see, you learn through books. Now what you here's the thing about it. You can test it. If you if you've read the other, you see, several lines. If you've read the other, you see, I read some verses the other day by the name of the painter, which opens his mind. It's not conventional and original. And it brings out one's genius. Let the subject be what it may. And in the subject of books, you see, you can test what he says about books by whether or not it will bring out one's own genius. Otherwise, whether it's an Emersonian book you talk about. Now he says, you see, most of the books we read use in school are for knowledge. And he's not interested in that. But the book he talks about has to do one thing. It has to go back to that statement in the first part of the other essay. The book is something that gives one that glimpse, that inner light. That's the Emersonian book. Now the statement, his finest statement on it, not one person in 100 would ever get it. Of course, there's a problem. There's a portion of reading quite indispensable to a wise man. History, exact science, he must learn by laborious reading. Colleges, in like manner, have their indispensable office to teach elements, but they can only highly serve us when they aim not to drill, but to create, when they gather from far every ray of various genius to their hospitable halls, and by the concentrated fires set the hearts of their youths on flame. And also on uses at the same time, with them stay up. And I don't know why it is, you see, that Emersonian book can't be transferred to Dimsdale and the election sermon. As if, you see, Hawthorne moved away from concord. Over influence. He couldn't be himself. To write the Scarlet Letter. But you see, Emerson still crops out in it, and some of it is so just Emersonian to a high degree. Last part on, you see, the scholar has to live, and the trouble with, you know, in the past is, all along has been, that the learned people are speculative and not practical. But you see, that's not true in long, you see, so much. We don't have that because most of the, you see, the practical people have just about taken over the universities, and you have a professor of logging. So this wouldn't be an issue. But Emerson's point is still valid. See, the scholar has to live. Now, I read that different now. I read it in the light of the tapes and of reporting. And you see what the heart of the reporting is, one's experience. And experience is something you see that you've looked at, examined. So that the scholar has to live and not be academic. And now I don't know this much about Emerson, but see, Thoreau's not academic. His experiences, you see, John Field, he has that little lesson economy, yes. But it's, look at the loom, there's no lesson in that. And in Emerson, you see, I don't know the biography well enough to say, but the thing about Emerson, I don't know what it was about Emerson that exerted so much influence. You know, it couldn't be pure thought. There was that magnetism about him.
Oh, that great personal magnetism.
Yes. It's that magnetism. And it was just a line of people that came to call on him and talk to him for hours at a time at Concord. You call about him a sage, and that's the wrong thing. So that, you know, he could, I don't know whether he stayed awake at night or not, like, say, Mama did about the widow's, the woman's problems, and making both ends meet. But he talked to all of them. And don't you know, Van Doren makes this marvelous little picture, you see. It's not in Athens. It's a very small place. But I forget how he puts it, but somehow Concord comes to life.
It's all.
You have to look at what he says about it. It's amazing. It comes to life. Instantly, when we talk to a person, only so much do I know as I have lived. Instantly, we know whose words are loaded with life and whose not. Now that's, you see, that's just. That's worth carrying along with you, and you can check it.
And that's that experience,
guys. That's the experience that I picked up from taping.
Yes,
you see,
making it live.
That up from my neighbors over here. You see, Mr. Patterson and Mr. Gilbert, and last year was election year. Mr. Morganson down here. He was a Wallace man, and. Yes, I worked that out. Theoretical. But they can recapture. And I'll tell you what happened. Mr. Mac Weaver was coming over here and taped talking to the machine about his hunts. He's had dogs all his life. And he's hunted all over this country. And he came from up in North Alabama. And you know what he did to talk about? He came over here with his mind filled with his first hunt 50 years ago. He didn't recall it. It was in his mind. He knew everywhere they went, the dogs' names and the people who were there. Now that's experience, you see. Now, here's a remarkable thing, you see, about Faulkner. I never realized that until I kind of got into this. Faulkner has all that experience, hardly any of it of his own. How much of his own, I don't know. But he can get it from Mack Weaver, I'm sure. He has that gift. So that Faulkner, when he writes, he don't know which generation he's talking about. You see, his mind goes from one generation to another. In this experience, and these, you see, his, you see, they, all the youngsters will tell you, you see, that they're not academic people. They don't believe that school is the most important thing. They think experience is, they have to live. But see, what they call living is just raw experience. They can't go to the picture show and think about it there too. They go to the picture show, and then when they start thinking, they got to go back again to the picture show. And get it raw, just raw emotion, never looked at.
It's not young people. It's,
oh, no.
It's everybody.
Yes.
They never look at what they've done.
They don't want to look at it.
They got to go on and move to something else.
Yes. But now here you have this, see. You have in the old genius, that was up until this generation, the genius of the people was this experience. They all had it. They all lived it. They live, in other words, one way of saying it is they live with themselves. Now look, I think the easiest way to see what happens, the freshmen come up there healthy and active. All these marvelous experiences with it that they bring up there, and every single member of the staff cuts them off. And throws them into this new world that they're actually not at home with, and pushes them to the point that they lose sleep and become big smokers, pollute the air, and just discard it where the experience is no more.
Loaded with classes.
Load them down. Load them down. Now, look here. Then he has this little section that I read through for the longest time. I don't know how in the world I ever noticed it. No one told me. It just came out during some little talk. What he calls the duties of the scholar. I've now spoken of the education of the scholar by nature of books and action. It remains to say someone of his duties. They are such as become man thinking. Now, I find that disturbing, this idea of man thinking. The office of the scholar is to cheer, to raise, and to guide men by showing them facts amidst appearances. Now, he's actually using philosophical terms, you see. That's the phenomena and the noumena. That's the outward things and the inward things. But that's that New England genius of that time, you see. But you see, now here, you see, to pass a course, an intellectual course, as we have it now, I don't think was ever done then. It's you see, the office of the scholar is to cheer. You see, the youngsters who come into your classes is to cheer so they won't be afraid of you, to raise, and to guide them by sort of giving them a few little...
Glimpses.
Just very slight. And I never learned it really from working with them like I have with the taping and adults. Just the easiest little touch, you see, will be a green light. The green light is so simple.
And you're looking for facts.
So simple and informative. Now, here, that's not really the heart of it. He plies the slow, unhonored, and unpaid task of observation. He plies it. Flamsteed and Herschel in Glaze Observer may catalog the stars with the praise of all men, and the results being splendid and useful, honor is sure. But the scholar, you see, not the scholar is everybody, but he in his private observatory cataloging obscure nebulous stars of the human mind, see, puts in a, it's a thankless, lasting, and he's poor all the time. But see, in the long period of his preparation, he must betray often in ignorance and shiftlessness and popular arts and incurring the disdain of the able who shoulder him aside. Long he must stammer in his speech, you see. But eventually, he is one who raises himself from private considerations and breathes and lives on public and illustrious thoughts. Mm-hmm. Now that's the duties of the scholar. The scholar, as he says here, then, has this public function. He lives this long, arduous, thankless, unknown,
life. Mm-hmm.
But eventually, you see, this is what happens to him. He is the one who raises himself from private consideration and breathes and lives on public and illustrious thoughts. So he sees Thoreau in a different light.
Now, Chanticleer.
You see, Thoreau is the scholar.
And he doesn't
go to Walden to withdraw.
To withdraw. No. Isn't this beautiful?
He goes in his public function. And he talks like Chanticleer. He must crow.
Now that's the end of Channel 1, right. The end of Channel 1, right, on the new reel, Barbara 2. The end of Channel 1, right, on the new reel, Barbara 2. That's the end of Channel 1, right, on the new reel, Barbara 2. That's just before we had lunch on this day. The time changed back about noon then. Sunday the 26th of October 69. Sunday the 26th of October 69. The end of Channel 1, right, on the new reel, Barbara 2, on Sunday the 26th of October 69.